Hello, everyone. This is Kay Tenenbaum with another edition of the Saturday Evening Post. In our last episode, we were looking at a piece of fiction written by Doug Kandrell called Winter Wheat. You will recall it was two brothers and their dad dealing with the crop and their next-door neighbor, Kenny. And as we wrapped up last week's episode, unfortunately, Kenny had passed away. It was early November when we learned of Kenny's death. The maples and sycamores were bare, the last fields of corn stark and empty. We'd been done with our own harvest for a couple of weeks and were grateful for some downtime. Derek had mentioned just the day before that we ought to ask Kenny if he needed any help. We hadn't seen him in more than a month. The last time had been at the grain elevator, where Kenny had hugged us in front of our father's friends, men with shaven faces and scoured work boots and pressed denim shirts. Kenny still wore his puka shell necklace and had a tiny braid behind one ear. He talked about his wife and baby, telling us we'd all get together after the first snow and go sledding. He even suggested our folks come along. We could hardly picture our father lying on a flexible flyer, wind blowing his cap off his cheeks red. That afternoon in November, Dad asked if we wanted to go take a look at the sprouting wheat. We eagerly agreed. The wheat had been ours to get into the ground, and we were proud of it. As we put on our boots and gloves, Dad seemed unsure about the wisdom of what he'd just asked us to do. He forced a smile and gave us each a pat on the back as we exited the house. Mom and the girls were grocery shopping for a big post-harvest meal that night. The weather was bitter and gray. We walked the length of a pasture and over another fence line to the periphery of one of our fields. 40 acres competed in a perfect Kelly green, a testimony to our labor. Blackbirds hopped over the verdant landscape. "Boys," Dad said, "that young guy, Kenny." He rubbed his hands together and looked at us standing in the cold. His voice grew softer. "It's a damn shame." "He slipped," they said. "He was picking corn alone. Didn't have much of a chance." We all knew what a combine could do to a person. My vision blurred, and the tears came fast. Derek kicked the ground and closed his eyes tight while Darren looked away and walked in a circle. "I know," said Dad. It was clear he was trying to offer up a side of himself that we needed just then, but he was unaccustomed to giving consolation. "Come on now," he said, and he pulled me to his chest. I sobbed, and he made a soothing sound that I'd heard him use to calm sows in labor. Then he handed me his handkerchief, and I blew my nose. Derek and Darren wiped their eyes with the cuffs of their jean jacket. "I'm sorry," said Dad. "I know you boys were fond of him." With that, he started to walk along the edge of the field, and we followed. Halfway down, Dad stopped and surveyed our work. He said, "We'd done a fine job getting the wheat in the ground. The following summer, we would harvest it together." 2 days later, Dad drove us to Kenny's funeral. He told Sarah that we'd plant her fields and harvest them, too. He even patted the baby's head. On the drive home, Dad told us a story we'd never heard, about a time when his brother had nearly been killed by a team of draft horses. "You never know," he said. We drove on past fields of winter wheat on either side of the road, all that beautiful green that would lie dormant under the white snow, safe from the sub-zero cold until spring, when the sun would return and it would grow again. In the fall, the grain would be separated from the chaff, which would be plowed under, as it had been so many times before. Doug Crandall is the author of 6 books, most recently the novel They're Calling You Home. His stories have appeared in Glimmer Train, The Sun Magazine, and Smithsonian Magazine. And next, we have Your Health. This could be habit-forming. Stacking a new habit on an old one is easier than starting from scratch. The neutral pathways of pre-existing habits are well-traveled routes in your brain. You can take advantage of this by associating a new habit with one that is established, says Rob Carter III, Ph.D., co-author of The Morning Mind, Use Your Brain to Master Your Day and Supercharge Your Life. He offers this example. If you want to create a new habit of exercising in the morning and reading the newspaper every morning, tie these activities together by exercising immediately before you read the paper. Reading the paper becomes your reward. When you learn for yourself how simple it is to change habits, you'll want to make adjustments to all areas of your life, experts add. From the medical mailbox of your health, this is written by Corey Servas, MD, and Wendy Braun, an RN. Blister blocker. Do linseed supplements help prevent cold sores? That came from Marilyn Cooper in an email. While studies show mixed results, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence that taking supplements of the amino acid lysine helps reduce flare-ups of cold sores by keeping the herpes simplex virus in check. Lysine is widely available, inexpensive, and safe. To help prevent flare-ups, the recommended dose is 1 gram daily. To shorten them, take 1 gram 3 times daily. Living with lupus. My sister was recently diagnosed with lupus. Any suggestions? This came from Christian Lewis from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Lupus is a disturbing yet manageable problem that occurs when rogue immune cells attack one's own organs. It can't be cured, but it is treatable, says Baylor College of Medicine rheumatologist Kalpana Bravanasu. Researchers are working on new ways to slow the progression of lupus and prevent worsening its symptoms. For support and updates, visit lupus.org and rheumatology.org. Three quick tips to help keep the disease at bay. 1. Don't ignore telltale symptoms such as persistent rashes. Not everything that looks like lupus is lupus, but early input from doctors can be hugely beneficial, says Dr. Benavarsu. 2. To protect your heart, don't smoke. Exercise as tolerated and keep weight in check to help stave off heart attack and stroke. 3. Avoid sun exposure. Reduce lupus flare-ups by wearing sunscreen and long-sleeve tops and avoiding maximal exposure between 10 a.m. and 2, she says. 5-minute fitness balance builder. Brush up on your balance skills. Using a broomstick can help improve core mobility and trim extra belly fat, says New York trainer and owner of JFit Training Studio, Justin Jefferson. The broomstick twist: stand tall with legs about shoulder width apart and broomstick held at hips. Step back with right leg, lowering right knee to floor, and raising broomstick to shoulder level. If needed for balance, place broomstick on floor directly in front of you. Hold position for up to 10 seconds, then return to standing position. Repeat with other leg. Repetitions: work up to 4 sets 3 times weekly. Ready for more? After step 2, which is step back with right leg, lowering right knee to floor, etc., slowly twist body and arms to left and back again. Repeat with other leg, twisting to the right. Weighing in, weight loss tips for carb lovers. Choosing carbohydrates wisely is key to losing weight. Personally, I love healthy carbs like oats, quinoa, brown rice, and fruits to provide energy, fiber, and multiple nutrients, says post-weight loss expert Dr. David Creel. Sidestep calories from pasta, rice, and potatoes, and feel fuller longer with his satisfying swaps. Instead of loading a baked potato with butter and sour cream, go for diced tomatoes, chives, spicy black beans, mushrooms, or lightly sautéed spinach. The savings? About 250 calories. Instead of a giant heap of pasta with garlic bread, go for pasta mixed with chicken and diced vegetables alongside a salad. Savings about 420 calories. And instead of making white rice the star of a vegetable and meat stir fry, go for cauliflower rice to accompany it. That's a savings of about 200 calories. Insight: dry eye when drops don't help. If drugstore artificial tears are no longer working, your doctor may suggest omega-3 supplements in conjunction with artificial tears. If that doesn't work, tests can determine if your problem is caused by decreased tear production due to tear gland blockage, increased tear evaporation, or tear composition imbalance. For a gland blockage, the use of a nightly moist heat compress may be recommended. Intense pulse light, IPL, and heat compression therapy have proven effective, and I have found we are using less prescription eye drops due to those excellent results. If you still need fighting visual discomfort after those treatment options, the next step is a prescription eye drop. That came from Francis W. Price, Jr., M.D., who is a world-renowned ophthalmologist and founder of the Cornea Research Foundation of America. That's cornea.org, a nonprofit dedicated to helping people back with the use of their eyes. From the pharmacy, this came from Kara Acklin, pharmacist, clinical pharmacist, board certified in ambulatory care. Drugs and dementia risk. New data connect some commonly prescribed drugs with an increased risk of cognitive decline. A study of adults aged 55 and older, published in the JAMA Internal Medicine, suggests the association is strongest with certain antidepressants, drugs to treat overactive bladder, or drugs to treat overactive bladder. Solid conclusions about whether these drugs cause memory issues will have to wait. Meanwhile, older adults, physicians, and pharmacists can work together to avoid these medications or to at least use them as little as possible and in the lowest dose necessary. Never stop taking any prescription drugs without first having a risk-benefit conversation with your doctor. Hazards of ultra-processed foods. This is Heartbeat. It's written by Douglas Zipes, M.D. I'm not much of a junk food eater, although I do like an occasional Steak and Shake double cheeseburger or a Big Mac with French fries, maybe a half dozen times a year, and more often, a grilled all-beef hot dog smothered in mustard and drowning in sauerkraut. My mouth waters as I write this. Mostly, though, I try to eat a reasonable, healthy diet, with emphasis on reasonably. However, the food experts are telling us with increasing clamor about the horrors of consuming ultra-processed food. What exactly are ultra-processed foods? They usually consist of junk foods such as chips and cookies and fast foods like prepackaged dinners. Such foods are industrial formulations with little intact food, generally containing low nutritional value, lots of calories, and packed with multiple ingredients to enhance flavor and prolong shelf life. Consumption of these foods has almost tripled between 1990 and 2010, from 11% to 32% of daily energy intake. New reports are underscoring the potential harm of this bad diet. In a study from Spain of almost 20,000 people followed for 15 years, people in the group consuming the most ultra-processed food, more than 4 servings daily, had a 62% greater risk of death than those consuming the least amount. The more ultra-processed food one consumed, the greater the risk. So for each additional serving, mortality increased by 18%. A similar study from the U.S. found that individuals in the highest quartile of eating ultra-processed food, stuff like sugar-sweetened or artificially sweetened beverages, sweetened milk, sausage, sweetened cereals, and desserts, had a risk of all-cause mortality that increased by 31%. A much larger study of 44,500 participants from France also found higher mortality among those consuming ultra-processed foods, but interestingly also noted that these participants were more likely to be younger, to live alone, to be physically inactive, and to have a lower income, lower educational level, and a higher body mass index. It is important to remember that some of these lifestyle influences can also contribute to mortality. So, which is cart and which is horse? Do lifestyle patterns contribute to eating junk food, or does eating junk food impact lifestyle? Very likely, both are operative and affect the development of cardiovascular and cerebrovascular diseases in this population. In a study of over 100,000 French participants, greater consumption of ultra-processed foods was associated with increased risk of heart attacks and strokes. These epidemiological reports are observational, and direct causality cannot be firmly established. But if the mortality outcomes are not sufficiently convincing to eat a proper diet, how about gaining or losing weight? For this, there exists hard science. A trial of 20 inpatient adults randomized to consume ultra-processed versus unprocessed foods, each for 14 days, found that those eating ultra-processed food consumed more calories and gained about 2 pounds during that time period, while those eating unprocessed food consumed fewer calories and lost about 2 pounds. Like many of us, I'm a bit overweight and I don't need much more convincing to limit my ultra-processed food intake than that outcome. So, readers, eat well, exercise, stop smoking, keep your blood pressure and cholesterol under control, and enjoy good health. But I still can't taste that delicious hot dog. Don't miss your weekly checkup by Dr. Douglas Zipes for updates on medical breakthroughs and advice on health living at SaturdayEveningPost.com/checkup. The Party Planner. This is Everyday Heroes, written by Ken Budd. While still in high school, Julia Warren started a nonprofit to celebrate the birthdays of disadvantaged kids. 32 squealing kids play baseball games on a basketball court in a Richmond, Virginia community center. They're smacking balloons with the party's 17 volunteers, competing in sack races, shooting baskets, throwing footballs, jumping rope, and screeching and yelling and dancing, pausing only for face painting before yelling some more. Remarkably, despite the chaos, only one balloon pops. Bang! Make that 2 balloons. No one is having more fun than the party's jubilant host, 23-year-old Julia Warren. She's the founder of Celebrate RVA, an organization that throws birthday parties for disadvantaged kids, most of whom have never worn party hats or blown out candles. Sometimes they're confused about why I lit their food on fire, she says. The kids love her. When we entered an elementary school that afternoon to gather children celebrating April birthdays, her young admirers swarmed her, offering smiles, hugs, and high decibel hellos. It's my shining stars, she said to the kids. Are you ready to celebrate birthdays? Warren formed the nonprofit in 2013 when she was 16 years old. Since then, Celebrate RVA has hosted more than 280 parties for around 3,250 kids. She's younger than me, and I look up to her. She's done all of this on her own, says Paige Sigler, 29, the organization's part-time, soon-to-be full-time program coordinator and its only other employee. So, what inspired Warren to become a Mother Teresa meets Chuck E. Cheese do-gooder when she was barely old enough to drive? As a junior in high school, Warren was tutoring kids at an elementary school. One day, she was chatting with a child and asked, "How old are you? When were you born?" The response changed her life. He looked up and said, "I think I was born when it was cold outside." Warren was stunned. She talked to the school principal. He said the school didn't have time to recognize birthdays, though sometimes they might give a child a pencil. Sad, right? So Warren used babysitting money to host birthday parties on her own. Soon she was contacted by local agencies and nonprofits. Having these professionals say, "This is a real need, and we're willing to invest resources to make this happen," I realized that this was going to be a lot bigger than myself. As she served the city, she was also thinking about college and considering two options. 62,000 student Texas A&M, which was half a country away, and Randolph-Macon College with 1,400 undergrads, about 20 miles from Richmond. If she went to Texas A&M, she would need to put Celebrate RVA on hold. Then, at a birthday party, a gentleman arrived and picked up a child and said, "We have to find a place for him to sleep tonight." That man was the boy's counselor. A few weeks earlier, the boy had watched as his mother was shot and killed in their home. No family member had yet offered to care for him. "It stopped me in my tracks," says Warren. "I thought, this child has gone through more than I will ever go through in my entire life. And yet, for the past hour and a half, we've been able to celebrate him and let him try to forget that horrific things he has seen and just be a child. And I knew that this is where I was supposed to be." She attended Randolph-Macon for 2 years and then devoted a year to Celebrate RVA. Her parents were both proud and concerned. "When this started and I was throwing a few birthday parties, they said, 'Oh, that's great, Julia.' And then when I said, 'I think I need to turn this into a nonprofit,' my parents were like, 'Well, shouldn't you pass algebra first?" After attending a few parties, her parents became her biggest supporters, but Warren had much to learn. She was a privileged private school girl throwing inner-city birthday parties. "The first few parties, I felt like an outsider," she says. "I had no relationships in this community. I hadn't proven myself trustworthy." She realized she needed to listen and accept feedback. Now, she says, she's not only been accepted, but parents call her at all hours. She also learned that her parties could wound parents' pride. "Most parents are truly hurt that they can't provide their child with a birthday experience," she says. To address that, she always seeks parental involvement, whether it's decorating party rooms or lighting the candles. Cynics may question her work. "Cupcakes and streamers are great," the party poopers say, "but don't disadvantaged kids have bigger needs?" "Every child deserves the right to experience joy," Warren explains. "But a lot of our kids don't know how. We've got elementary schoolers being recruited by gangs. They're rejecting the idea that happiness is something they can attain." Warren grasped the transformative power of parties at one of her first events, held at Safe Harbor, a domestic violence shelter. Members of the city's pro soccer team, the Richmond Kickers, attended as volunteers, but their presence frightened the women and children. "The last time they were touched by a man, it was probably extremely violent," says Warren. The players, however, spoke softly and bent down to eye level with the kids. They played in sprinklers, engaged in sidewalk chalk drawing, and sang "Happy Birthday." When the party was over, the women and children extended their arms for hugs. "I had to hold back tears because I saw what an hour and a half of celebration and joy can do," says Warren. "We've talked to teachers who say, 'My kids keep their birthday card on their desk year-round. It's their only birthday card, and they love to look at it and read the special message.'" Warren is finishing her education, yet continues to expand the organization and recruit volunteers, such as Alicia Feliciano, who volunteers monthly with her husband, 11-year-old daughter, and 14-year-old son. Working with Celebrate RVA, Feliciano says, has strengthened her family. As the kids assume more responsibilities at parties, they've become more respectful and responsible at home. Julia knows how to empower people, says Feliciano. She can inspire a 5-year-old as easily as a 60-year-old. Next up for Warren, Celebrate RVA is building a community center that will open in 2020. But parties remain the organization's focus, and for Warren, the most emotional moments come after the children make birthday wishes. Inevitably, one or two kids keep their eyes closed. They keep making a wish for like 30 seconds, she says, and they're muttering to themselves. All I can do is wonder what they're wishing for. Warren knows she can't rescue these kids, but she can give them moments of happiness and love that continue to burn, she hopes, like a candle on a cupcake. And that is Julia Warren's birthday wish. Ken Budd is the author of The Voluntourist and the host of 650,000 Hours, an upcoming web series on travel and real-life American heroes. Here's the backstory by Julia Bricklin, Annie Oakley's fierce rival. By reinventing herself as Indian, Lillian Smith became a Wild West sensation and escaped an unhappy past. At about 10:30 a.m. on the morning of August 3, 1901, more than 100,000 people jostled to catch a glimpse of Frederick Cummings' Indian Congress Parade at the Pan American Exhibition in Buffalo, New York. The crowds shrieked with excitement when they heard the Carlisle India Band strike up a tune and drew a collective gasp when three celebrities appeared on their respective steeds. There was Geronimo, the aged Apache chief, and Martha Calamity Jane Canary, the frontierswoman and scout of the American Plains. And then there was Winoa, the Sioux girl. Winoa Cummins, proclaimed, was not only the champion rifle shot of the world, but also the daughter of chief named Crazy Horse. And white woman born in a teepee on the south bank of the Big Cheyenne near Fort Bennett, Dakota. And only 18 years old. Cummins offered a $1,000 reward to anyone who could best Winoa with a rifle at the exhibition. Her extraordinary shooting prowess, he crowed, had been bestowed upon her by supernatural spirits of the Indian world. In fact, Winona was not a Sioux teen. She was 29-year-old Lillian Frances Smith, the daughter of a white Quaker couple from New England. A former performer in William Buffalo Bill's Cody's Wild West show, she had earned the scorn of the legendary Annie Oakley and had been cast aside to make her own way in the world. At the cusp of 30, the so-called California girl may have thought that adopting a Native American persona was her last chance to differentiate herself from Oakley. At least, this is what my original thesis was when I first examined the sparse records that Smith left in her own writing before her death in 1930. I had been casting about for a California figure to write about, and tripled over mention of Smith in a footnote in an article about someone else. I had to piece together a sparse collection of Smith's letters, newspaper accounts, playbills, accounts of those who worked with her, and genealogical sources to find her real story. And her real story, I found, had little to do with Oakley. It was not even so much that a rehabilitated Indian could sell a lot of tickets at that time, though that was certainly part of it. As I collected more and more sources, I concluded that the primary purpose of Smith's transformation into Winona was so that Smith could completely erase her past and start all over again in typical American fashion. Smith was a darling of Buffalo Bill's 1886 to 1887 Wild West show. Once was at a loss, exclaimed one observer of the show in New York, whether Miss Lillian Smith, Miss Annie Oakley, Johnny Butler and the Kid, Cowboy Will Lanoy, or Buffalo Bill himself, deserved the highest praise for marksmanship. Well, that wraps up this section of the Saturday Evening Post. I'm Kate Tenenbaum, and I'll talk with you next week. Good night.